The talk today is called Emptiness, Operating Instructions. And the reason I give this talk is because I wasn't given any when I was 20 and came to India to learn meditation. To talk slowly. Thank you. I'll do my best. Thank you for reminding me. When I first came to India 24 years ago, I'd been trying to learn meditation from Ram Dass books, and I didn't think I was doing very well, so I went to India, I came to India, to get some live instruction, some actual teaching. And I was very fortunate to receive some very live teachings. Some people like to make a distinction between kind of dead words, recorded words, words that are just being repeated, and live words, live teachings, not just that they're happening right now and not recorded on our various devices, but a kind of living quality in the words, a living quality in the interaction and connection. So the living quality was there, but the words themselves were not doing very much for me. And I had this very strong, even heavy question when I would hear about teachings of emptiness and mindfulness. The question was, where is the love? And another version of the question, the same question, in other words, is emptiness, so what? And mindfulness, yes, fine, and then? And I'm aware that there are at least a few people in the hall who may have never heard the word emptiness, or even mindfulness. Hallelujah, I get to fill in the blank first. So there was some living quality that drew me towards meditation. But what the teachers were saying, the actual content or instructions, be aware of the intention to lift your foot, be aware of the sensation of lifting your foot, be aware of the intention to move your foot forward, be aware of the sensation of moving your foot forward, be aware of the intention to place your foot down, be aware of the sensations of putting the foot down. Okay, I can kind of do it, and then? What does that have to do with anything? And then this word emptiness, that gave a sense of as if the in examining ourselves and our lives, what we would eventually come to do would be to be like an empty container, hollow and without life. That was the feeling that I got when I heard the word emptiness 24 years ago. What does that have to do with anything? It felt like we're supposed to kind of pretend to be quiet, calm, still, without thought, without care, without response, as in Zohar's group, the ability to respond. And luckily, the teachers were not trying to give me that teaching. That's not what they meant. But there was a kind of cultural gap going on. The living quality in those people was very clear, the sense of humor, even the physical agility. So one of the teachers was quite elderly, but he would play, what is that? I just saw a child playing it now. if you play soccer or football and you play with keeping the ball up in the air, juggling the thing, but it's a ball of rubber bands. What is that called? Hacky sack. Hacky sack, yeah. So hacky sack was popular in 1987. And Menindraji would play hacky sack with some of the other people who were learning meditation from him. Which is a wonderful contrast for our minds when we hear of a actually very famous, great meditation teacher who was a teacher for many of the great modern Western meditation teachers, like Jack Kornfield and Joseph Goldstein and Sharon Salzberg and Ram Dass, playing hacky sack after lunch. The playfulness was there, the sense of humor was there, a kind of glow was there. But the word emptiness didn't give me any track to follow. It didn't resonate with me at all. And so I'd like to give a few options to you about even why this word emptiness was chosen as one good word to talk about what is. Not the only one. So I would like to talk about the experiential quality of emptiness in our daily life and in our meditation practice. Am I talking fast? Fast? Or it's okay. Okay. And nowadays, when we buy new technology, it seems that the companies have kind of surrendered to our being in a hurry. And so there seems to be the short instructions with a lot of images, not many words, so that you don't blow up the new computer before you have a chance to read the 300-page manual, before you have a chance to look through the 7 different languages and find your language to actually read, how to turn it on. So the short operating instructions for emptiness. The first is plug in to lightness. So lightness is another way of feeling our way into emptiness. Emptiness in the sense of not solid, not solidified, not actually weighing us down. So even if we feel a heavy sensation, whether emotionally or physically, the heaviness can be felt as a very precise, alive, ungraspable feeling that doesn't weigh us down. So plugging into not solid, plugging into lightness, number one. Number two, which is the last, there's only two in the short instructions. Plug into lightness and then allow what is important to stay front and center, right in front of you, or right in your core. And now we can flip through the thick manual. Try to find your language. And try to find out how this thing called life works. In this case, I think why I'm calling it operating instructions is that instead of starting from the concept of emptiness and then trying to kind of fit, like shove my experience into what I think that concept means, if we can start from our own experience and feel how that might start to sound a lot like emptiness. But first, as those of you who know me know, I would like to just float a poem in. This is a translation of a spontaneous song or poem sung by someone who lived in Varanasi centuries ago, who no one knows which tradition he was from. And he just kept living his normal life as a weaver. And when someone would come and ask a question, or someone would come to him with a question without asking, then something might come in words. And apparently he would sing it. I'm going to try my best not to sing this song, although I do happen to know it in Hindi. This translation is by a friend named Peter, whose partner Christine was just with us for most of this gathering. And I'm going to actually change the translation a little bit to be closer to the Hindi now that I look. The refrain of the song is, open your veil. So in India, if you stay long enough, you'll realize that if you're not wearing one of these, you're nearly naked if you're female. And sometimes you see it like this, sometimes you see it like this, etc. So it's an easy image that Kabir would come up with living in the Muslim quarter. So it's in Hindi, open your veil. It's often translated into English as draw back or remove your veil, but it actually is open. Open your veil. Open your veil, then you will meet your beloved. I'm skipping a couple of the lines that are not so relevant. And then the last three lines of the song that came spontaneously out of nowhere to Kabir. Lamps are lit in the palace of emptiness. Sunna Mahalame, in the palace of emptiness. Diya Jalai, the lamp is burning. And then there are two different versions of the next line. Let that light not flicker from false hope. So when we get into false hope, the light may flicker. Or another way to say it is Sunna Mahalame Diya Jalai. Don't move from your seat, your asanse. Asanase matadolare. Don't you flicker from your seat, from your place. So there's a palace of emptiness, but we have a place in it where we could be steadiness itself, where the tiniest movement would make the light flicker. Through loyalty to our, we could call it yoga practice, or through loyalty to that union, the meaning of yoga, that togetherness, that not-to-ness, loyalty to that not-to-ness, in the wedding pavilion, so in the wedding palace, we could say, find the priceless love or lover. And in another version, find the priceless jewel. Jewel without price. But here in Peter's version, it's actually find the priceless beloved. We could say the priceless love, measureless love. I'll save the very last line. Open your veil and you'll meet your beloved. So then, of course, the question is, what is the veil? And how do I open it? It is obvious to us, whether we meditate or not, but when we start trying to meditate. And we often would first get those instructions of close your eyes and try to feel your breath. And because, especially when we're unsure of ourselves, am I doing it right? There starts to be a feeling that there is a breath that I've got to kind of catch up with, or I've got to find a way of catching it. I've got to make sure that I know that I'm feeling my breath. And so the idea of the breath starts to be something we run after. And our actual experience of the breath that keeps coming to us, If we would just remove that veil of insecurity, making the breath into something that it isn't, that then I'm not good enough to catch. But just as it is, it's not quite a thing, but we can feel it. It's every time different. It also has a rhythm. It keeps coming back until it doesn't. And so that we might hear, like, don't let the lamp flicker with false hopes. And so we try to make some kind of steadiness. We try to invent some kind of steadiness. We try to invent some kind of equanimity, not moving. But we're trying to meet in intimacy a breath, which is impossible to actually hold on to. It's impossible to describe, even. And so if we kind of acknowledge and have permission to let our experience be like that, and that it's not something wrong with us, it's not something wrong with our technique, it's not something wrong with the technique, it's just a little problem in the language and in our approach to doing things. Out of shame, thinking that there is a right and a wrong way, we already, before we start, cover ourselves with a veil. And it's also so simple. Opening the veil, the actual experience, just as it is. And in those moments where we actually feel it, just letting it be. Hardly anything. And at the same time, so rich in pages we couldn't describe. When we let it be and we let it be met, there's a feeling of at least enoughness, if not a kind of brimming over of nourishment. At the same time that we're not trying to make it into a complete thing that we've got, like we've got the rope around it. As we let it be, never completing, never ending, there's a kind of completeness that happens. That's a symptom of emptiness. So some people say, don't worry if you don't resonate with the word emptiness, because all it means is fullness. Which is partly true, and partly an escape. It's partly too simple to say, oh, it's just fullness. Just as it is too simple to say, it's just emptiness. But one meaning of emptiness is fullness in that way, in that experiential way. The breath, or just now, if you like, any perception, physical experience or color or sound, if we let it be as it is, not catchable, but definite, totally itself, that color. So just try, like your shoulder or the color of the floor or the texture of anything or a sound. When we let it have its living quality, without trying to make it match our idea of living quality, There's a feeling of completeness as well as not quite separate from. Not quite me and my breath, me and the sound. So just, I want to kind of tuck a little suggestion in here. If we can let our experience be that ungraspable, and we're just right now talking simply about perception and just regular experience, any experience. The way that we can't ever quite say when it did begin. Even if we talk about an in-breath, we could say there's a moment that the diaphragm started pulling down, the lungs started opening, and the air started coming in. We might be able to catch that moment, but is that the beginning of the in-breath? Or what else is involved in allowing that in-breath? Not quite being able to pinpoint and define beginning and end. Not quite being able to honestly say good or bad, but not also able to say nothing's happening. If we can appreciate that lightness of being that allows experiences to be themselves, then we could remember how easily an idea comes in and kind of shatters the realness of the experience. Especially ideas of good and bad. It happens inside us, it happens outside us. And so this is just a kind of keep in mind how it may happen. You just had a meal. And there were specific tastes, and there was specific conversation, specific company, specific vibe, specific texture of the table, specific weather, specific everything. You could not describe all of that in your life. And if we were receptive and intimate with all of that, or with some of it, there might have been a sense of really enjoying the texture of the rice and really being surprised by the bitterness of the lemon when we were expecting sour. And then the meal is over, it seems to be. We could sort of generally call like the meal is over, we paid and we're going. And whoever was with us says, oh, that was really good. Or that was horrible. God, never want to go back there. And what that comment does, excuse me, what that comment does to our access to our experience, to how our experience is available to us, how easily a comment turns into a kind of gossip without necessarily being meant as gossip. It might just be someone feels insecure and there's been a lot of silence and I feel like inner pressure to just say something. And so I say, oh, that was really good. And of course it's not that now no one's allowed to say I liked or I didn't like. But just allowing the comment to be one more very alive, letting the comment also have its living quality. Not letting the opinion block us from the living quality that keeps going on. Because there is a way that that meal didn't end. There's a way that that meal continues. There's a way that in time, all those moments have at least a potential timeless quality. And we can stay in touch with the timeless. We can kind of keep our toes in the timeless with the passage of time. It's important enough to take this suggestion one step further. Because of our vulnerability to each other and to each other's opinions, isn't it important to stay in touch with the living quality of us in interaction with others and to notice how easily and why we're swayed by other people's opinions of other people? Very often, the opinions are not stated because we're good spiritual people. We would never say that we don't like so-and-so, and we really like so-and-so. But it comes across even more clearly. If someone might make the statement, "I don't like so-and-so," then we might feel, "I'll defend that so-and-so." But when it just turns into a dynamic that goes against so-and-so, it's very interesting how hard it is for us not to get swept away by that. So some precision in our own experience, staying with our actual precise living quality of experience with people. I feel uncomfortable with that person. Yes. That gives me some fertile ground to kind of grow into. Why do I feel uncomfortable with that person? Why do I feel drawn to that other person? Yes, I feel drawn towards. Why do I feel drawn towards? Is it coming from a basic, not core, but very deep insecurity? Wanting protection, wanting not to be left out with that outsider, etc. Does that make sense? If I'm with my precise, actual quality of experience with other people, and not the opinion, I have so much fertile ground to grow into. The transformation can keep going with the fact of feeling at ease and not at ease with different people without entering politics. So we had the different experience today of a Sarnath that was more empty of traffic, thanks to politics, the election today. Can be another experiential lived example of what can be freeing about the quality of emptiness, of a street empty of buses, empty of cars, nearly. And how that is quite similar in quality to a mind empty of thoughts, or nearly. We could feel today how the fact that there were a few motorcycles packed with five guys speeding because they could, because there was space. But basically a lot of room is a nice contrast for those who have been here in the previous days. And similarly, where there might be those moments that we can remember or that we could even enter into sometimes on purpose, where the mind is free of thoughts or nearly free of thoughts. And nearly free of thoughts is quite good enough. And what happens when there's a sense of spaciousness in the mind? I think this is an easy way of feeling an experiential quality of emptiness. Even if it's like, oh, how nice that would be someday. Or how refreshed we are by sleeping. But if we don't just leave it at that, oh, that would be so nice. But what else happens when there's space in the mind because there's less thinking? And what helps us, other than sitting still or lying still or standing still or walking slowly, what else helps us come to that kind of clean mind? So again, if the book says, sit still with your back straight and watch your breath, and that's the way to a clean mind, then it's easy for us to let that become a kind of gossip, opinion, or limited view that takes us away from our actual experience that running or dancing or swimming is also really, really good to find a clean mind. Even the simple kind of repetitive work, like sweeping, let's say, that in the West we think of as something better to get a machine to do, or an immigrant. And so we don't go to the garden, and we don't go to the kitchen, and we don't chop the vegetables that we planted. And then we go to gardening therapy. Or we go on retreat, and what we most want to do is chop vegetables as our meditation in action. So just kind of allowing that kind of healing, where we do know how good it is to pull weeds, if weeds need to be pulled, to plant seeds, to just be in the garden and feel what needs to happen and what doesn't. To be in the kitchen, to be with the toilet, etc. The simple, repetitive, grounding activity sometimes is what's most needed. One benefit being that clearness, spaciousness in the mind. So what happens when there is that spaciousness in the mind? What else goes on other than just spaciousness in the mind? Because what would be the point? It's a nice experience. And so what? Eating ice cream is also a nice experience. One thing that happens is what we could call real thinking. Sometimes it almost always feels like as if for the first time, a real thought. Not just repeating. A thought that has a living quality, that's not predictable, not a recording. A living quality often means that there's help involved, or a kind of breakthrough. Breaking through of limitations that we had lived by, that we had lived by as if it were our skin. So opening those veils. This is the part in the poem where opening the veils, we meet our beloved. When there's some space, now we're talking about in the mind, still just the thinking mind, a bit of space. Some kind of real meeting, a real thought. Sometimes I like to call it casual thinking. It's thought that's not trying to get a certain result. It's not controlling. We could call it free thinking. It's as if the thought really comes out of the depths of emptiness, the great potential that seems to be nothing, comes as if out of nowhere. An insight that turns our life around. So not gossip that kind of covers us up and turns us in a predictable direction that we will regret, but an insight that opens us to meet living quality. This is a kind of moment or transition where we've been practicing mindfulness, we've been practicing generosity, we've been practicing love. We've been practicing softness. And by not holding on to the idea of your practice, that intention towards love, generosity, clarity, presence, helps us slip into the real thing, a spontaneous, natural love, spontaneous, natural generosity, spontaneous, natural presence, that we can call mindfulness if we want, because it shares with mindfulness the capacity, the ability with presence to allow the attention to be drawn to what needs attention right now, which might be inside or outside of me. Something happens to catch our attention within that kind of field of presence. And we don't think, oh, I'm distracted from the breath. There's a living quality in that meeting. There's a naked quality. There's a tender quality. So we allow the intention to be drawn without knowing what this meeting is about. Seeing a tear on someone's face across the field. Or seeing someone stumble. Or just feeling something that you may have not quite noticed in the same way in your chest today. And not turning away from that. Just by allowing within the field of presence for that coincidence of attention to meet. So life as attention to meet some event. And not rushing to find how to deal with this once I realize something's happening here. There's a meeting going on. But staying how-less and just continuing to allow living quality from within to meet living quality within or without. This draws upon the way that we're not alone and separate. So one kind of lame definition of emptiness that I've been given more times than I'd like to count is emptiness doesn't really mean emptiness in the sense of hollow. It means empty of separate self, empty of separateness. What a long way around. What a long way around to say togetherness. What a long way around to say we could never be separate, no matter how hard we try, no matter how much we've been taught to pretend. But these different qualities that come upon us, let's say as if out of nowhere, a field of presence, attention is drawn to, we allow the meeting, and love happens. It seems to draw upon that not separateness as a resource for mutual transformation. Isn't it so? And so we can start to get the feeling for when I'm about to meet the beloved. Let me undress. We can stop putting so much investment in the meanings that we give to things. And we can be less afraid of the phrase meaningless, meaningless experience or meaningless life. When we say, oh, it was very meaningful, what we mean usually is like rich and connected and fulfilling, nourishing, complete, unending, timeless. But if we put too much importance into our limited meaning for our experience, so we drink a chai, and what we're really doing is holding the idea of a cup of chai and putting the idea of a drink of chai into the idea of our mouths and the idea of our stomachs and having the idea of a conversation. The cup of chai just means cup of chai and has certain associations for us, positive and negative. There's not all the other fullness of life there in our experience, but in 1 second it can be there. It's so easy to undress the experience. And the cup of chai is made of earth by someone. And there are temperatures and textures and tastes again, unnameable. We can notice when there's an emotional charge with an experience. That's often what we mean by meaning. So there's an emotional charge. And when there's an emotional charge, now we come to, okay, fine, a mind that's free of thought sounds really good. But what about a heart, an empty heart? It's a little bit harder to understand or feel or think why it would be worth having. A heart that's free of emotional charge. A heart that's free of walls. So even when emotional charge comes up, or we come upon a wall, and honestly, there's a wall, we can feel it. Heart free of wall, heart free of emotional charge, means we also have access to some quality of a human being that doesn't take the experience of a wall or a veil or an emotional charge. As being that important. We don't take the emotional charge as a place to start from, to react from, to move from. We don't let that be our fuel. We don't let that be what gets us going. When emotional charge gets us going, we have a thing about pollution, or we have a thing about traffic. Or we have a thing about tone of voice, or whatever we have our things about. We can just come back to the precision of our actual experiences. I have a thing about is the most important part of the sentence. And what I've noticed time and again is if I have a thing about it, I'm actively participating in it, and I'm probably literally doing it. I have a thing about pollution. You're probably doing it. if you could see the whole picture. And not just kind of in far-fetched ways, but literally throwing something on the ground or whatever. So there could be a deep caring about letting the earth also be empty of pollution. That possibility. Without the emotional charge being the starting point, what moves us. We could imagine actually having an empty gas tank, an empty petrol tank. The usual fuel for us is the emotional charge. If we could just let that run out, wouldn't it be lovely? We would be bewildered. We wouldn't know how to meet each other at first. We would just be, who are you and who am I? And what are we doing here? And just given a split second more than is comfortable, noticing that the veil is gone. And what happens there in that meeting? So I mentioned this experience that I think we've all had, whether we've recognized it or not. We haven't been taught to recognize it, so if you think you haven't had that experience of presence, attention being drawn to something important that happens to be important in this moment, might need a response, might just need attention, might just be about not a problem, but connection is possible. Connection would be part of the mutual transformation, allowing our potential to come into realization. It's a kind of coincidence that happens. It's a kind of synchronicity. And when we start to notice that our experience is like that, that coincidence happens, synchronicity can happen when there's open veil, openness, we get less and less interested in the idea of controlling, the idea of pointing things towards a particular direction or even beautiful vision, even the best vision that we could come up with. We get less and less interested in trying to drive circumstances that way. And more enjoying the lightness of allowing things to take place. With this investment, our investment of openness. So not investing things and emotional charge and demand. Usually there's a vision that we want to go towards, like that beautiful meditation or realization or a peaceful planet. And sooner or later we start to get pushy with it. And we're unable to receive the living quality of what's going on and the potential now, what's important to happen now, what's possible to happen now. Through the vehicle of our openness. We would have also noticed that sometimes when we're left feeling helpless or hopeless, or uninterested in being pushy, even for the best of reasons, we might just feel ease and our usual defenses happen to have fallen down. We're not running away from a problem so that we can try to fix the problem. We're not running away from suffering to find shelter somewhere safe. and not noticing that that never happens. There's a kind of stillness. We allow that extra split second of not being moved, not being pushed around by the worry, by the wish to go back into our emotional charge. We would have noticed that life doesn't stop there. We would have noticed that something does then happen next. We give up on all our devices out of helplessness because none of it worked, or just simply out of feeling how unnecessary to add anything to this. As if out of nowhere, we are moved. It's as if we can say in language, it's hard to go, but emptiness moves by itself. Our openness allows a movement to happen. And it's not only about being of service to the greater good in the way that we usually think of it as a kind of utilitarian, but also we could expand the meaning of service to the greater good, the importance of just beauty, unneeded, like the coordinators buying sweets today. It's completely unnecessary, and there's something nourishing about just the fact of knowing that that happened, whether I have a sweet or not. It's not in the sweet. It's not in the sweet. So if we can allow our experience to show itself, there are things that are more nourishing than food, that are not, strictly speaking, needed. It's not about the utilitarian survival mindset. I remember one time leading a meditation, lying down, as we do on the deep rest retreats. People are sometimes shocked on their first deep rest retreat that even the teachers sometimes lie down up here. It does limit sometimes where we can offer retreats. So far, so good. And I had a really nice nap. I think I could hear myself snoring. And towards the end of the 45 minutes allotted to the meditation, something woke up in me before I quite woke up. And the quality was breeziness, airiness, lots of space, right up, not only kind of lateral space, but just simple also. Wasn't psychedelic. It was just simply easygoing breeziness. And what was allowed into that breeziness was a kind of kindness or sweetness. And I remember this particular moment especially because there was a sound in the distance. We were in the desert, so there weren't so many sounds. But there was a sound, and it wasn't like the mountain goats of the desert or whatever. It wasn't the flowers opening in the desert. It was a garbage truck. And without thinking, oh, the garbage truck, and so kind of that person to be picking up the garbage. And it wasn't a thinking process, but before I could even recognize garbage truck, there was a kindness that was kind of floating towards, into, and through that sound and that event called garbage truck. Krishnamurti gives In one of my favorite quotations that I've traveled around with for years, a lovely description of what he's calling in this quotation meditation, which is another word for experiential emptiness. I'm calling today experiential emptiness. And I knew I would have to give you more of the quotation than I was trying to keep it short, but it's too delicious. Meditation, so experiential emptiness, eyes open, closed, in the hall, out of the hall, is the movement of love. It isn't the love up for the one or the many. It's like water that anyone can drink out of any jar, whether the jar is made of gold or clay. So he says, whether golden or earthenware, it is inexhaustible. So that nourishment that comes as if from out of nowhere, that's not because we're having a good experience. It is that the nourishment is there, it's available, whether we deserve it or not, whether we could buy it or not. Whether we're having a good day or a bad day, a golden day or an earthen day. And a peculiar thing takes place which no drug or self-hypnosis can bring about. It is as though the mind enters itself, beginning at the surface and penetrating ever more deeply until depth and height have lost their meaning and every form of measurement ceases. So that sounds kind of a bit dramatic, and I want to just say what he's talking about is just this simple. There's space. There's not agenda. We're just still waking up. And something in us can wake up before we do and just allow this kind of kindness or sweetness to be in the breeze. There's absolutely not even a mention of measurement or comparing. Krishnamurti says there's complete peace, not because we got what we wanted, not through gratification, but a peace that has order, beauty, and intensity. So when we enter the palace of emptiness and don't move from there, we don't leave our seat there, our place there, our asana, we allow there to be stillness as well as the flame, the aliveness that can move, that is energy. There can be intensity with beauty. There can be the unpredictability with a kind of order that's not predictable. So we can leave behind our time pressure. Our time pressure to dive into the timeless. Because there is intensity that comes by itself. So this is the part I wanted to get to. It can all be destroyed as you can destroy a flower. And yet, because of its very vulnerability, it is indestructible. So it's so easy to leave behind, so easy to cover up, so easy to not tune in to the subtlety. It's so easy to want to get away from our idea of that vulnerability. The experience of openness, there's nourishment and steadiness and insight and help and non-separation. But the idea of the openness, the vulnerability, freaks us out. It's so easy to leave it behind. And yet, because it has nothing to do with these other movements that come from fear or worry, it's not really bothered by. those other movements. It's still here. No matter what we do, no matter how many thoughts we have, we're not destroying emptiness. We're not destroying what is. And then finally he says, this meditation cannot be learned from another. We begin without knowing anything about it and move from innocence to innocence. So instead of the shame of not knowing anything about it, I don't know how to do it, and it's so subtle, so complex, it sounds so far away. If we appreciate the freshness of our innocence, of our not knowing, and the importance of allowing us the powerful experience of not knowing how, not knowing how to go from here. There's nothing wrong. That is absolutely the most helpful. The most helpful feedback from our experience, the most helpful honesty is we don't know how. If we would try to know how, we would be destroying. We would be destroying our access to what is, to the living quality. So in the palace of emptiness, which in the next line Kabir calls a wedding pavilion, but really it's also a wedding palace, it's the same word. Mahal, it's a palace. But he's saying wedding pavilion, where we meet the priceless love. The love that we don't even, when we're in that intimacy, we don't, of course, even think of. Yes, it is boundless. Yes, it does go up to the sky and all around, and the garbage truck is included. Yes, but we don't experience it in the way it sounds when we hear the description. In the wedding pavilion, we can allow the living quality, the nourishment, the okayness that's in the background no matter what happens. We can stay intimate with the love that just comes out of nowhere. Our openness allows it to come out of nowhere. We can allow it to come through in work and rest. When we feel walls and when we don't feel walls, when we feel separateness and when we don't feel separateness, when we feel together, when we feel alone. And just lastly, to come back to the original language of Kabir's poem, Gungatake Patakolare Tohe, like opening the veil, Piyamalenge, you will meet the beloved. So sometimes we're hoping that love will happen, that we'll meet love, that will be loving, that will feel love, that will find love. Love being that other word for emptiness. Opening the veil. In the Hindi, there's no need for the subject. You will meet your beloved. It just says, beloved will meet. And so sometimes the beloved will meet you, and it feels the beloved comes. I love how it's the beloved in this image of the poem. What we so deeply know to be true and important. And sometimes you will meet your beloved. There's no subject, but beloved will meet. It could even be they will meet. And technically in the Hindi, depending on the context, they will meet your beloved. in your intimacy with that love, it will shine from you. They will also meet your beloved. You will meet your beloved. Your beloved will meet you. Thank you for listening. Let's just have a couple minutes silence. May we allow the innocence of our actual, fresh, living experience teach us emptiness, meditation, love, fullness. The falseness of the sense of separation, the no need for shame. The no need to hide in emotional charge. The no need for anything extra. May our living practice and our innocent lives be of benefit to all. And contribute to the momentum towards liberation everywhere.